test? You guys don't hear anything?
Test, dude.
We are so pleased to be out here in Greater Nebraska, in my belief, one of the prettiest places in the state. We welcome all of you, both college students and high school students. It's great to see so many here today. And we are most appreciative of the college for organizing this event. And I think let's give the college another round of applause. My name is Frankie Moore, and I am currently the chief judge of the Court of Appeals. My district for the state is the 6th Judicial District, which encompasses, I think at last count, 46 counties. So I am your representative judge in this area of the state. I'm pleased to be joined to my right by Judge Everett Inbody from Wahoo, and to my left, Judge Francie Reedman from Gretna. It was good to bring some of the Eastern Nebraska judges out to Greater Nebraska. So we are very pleased to be here. I know that Judge Harford gave you a snapshot of how cases get before the appellate court, so I won't repeat that. I believe most of you had access to our case summaries today. We are going to hear 4 cases. We'll hear from the attorneys and the parties involved in those cases. And when we finish with that, then we'll stay for a few minutes, 20, 30 minutes, and answer questions from you. And we won't be able to talk about the particular cases, but we can sure talk about the procedure, any questions you have about the judiciary in general. So we're here hopefully to interact with you. So with that, we will start with our first case this morning, which is State versus Sherbarth. Good morning, Mr. Hyland.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Whenever you're ready.
We are ready.
Failing to instruct on a lesser included offense causes the problem of forcing a jury to convict when they feel a crime has occurred, but they don't feel that the evidence has been proven to the greater offense. And in this instance, that's one of the concerns of this case. I'm Bell Hyland, as you already introduced. I represent the appellant, Mr. Sherbarth, in this case. And what's interesting is that lesser included offenses bring together the connection between theory, whether or not you've proven your case beyond a reasonable doubt, and practice, whether or not a jury thinks something happened, but they're not willing to acquit someone because they think something happened and they want somehow to be punished or convicted for a crime in that case. And that's what happened in this case with Mr. Sherbarth. We asked for this was a charge of willful reckless driving. We asked for a lesser included of reckless driving. That request was denied, and I think it's pretty clear the district court was right. That was error.
Excuse me, Mr. Hyland, is your proposed jury instruction on reckless driving part of our record?
You know, I don't remember. I guess that issue hadn't been brought up. I thought I cited to it, but I don't remember if I did or not. I
did see an instruction proposed on the definition of recklessly, which the court did give as
right.
Part of the willful reckless driving elements.
I forgot I'd have to look that up because that hasn't been an issue, I guess, that's been raised, mm-hmm. So I apologize mm-hmm. for that. But I think it's clear from the instructions that willful reckless driving would include a reckless, which is a lesser included offense, is clear from what the terms of the statute can be easily identified and directed to it, so that's not an issue or a concern, I think, for the judge to be able to do so. So then we get to, it was error to fail to give. The district court was right in finding that. The issue then becomes what's prejudice. And that's where we get into a little more gray area. And I think the district court judge confused the issue of if a step instruction had been given versus if a step instruction had not been given. Because he says, well, there was enough evidence to convict and therefore we don't have to worry about it. But that then ignores Blair, which says step instructions are important. Lesser included instructions are important because we understand that juries comprised of people, that these people can make mistakes because they think something occurred. This was bad conduct. We're not disputing that at all. It just didn't rise to the level of a willful reckless driving. And therefore, by only instructing on a willful reckless driving, they remove from the jury the ability to determine intent. What kind of intent was involved in this case for Mr. Sherbar's case? And in a number of the cases that I cited in the brief, they talked about it's important for the jury to make that determination and not be forced to convict someone just because they believe that there is a more that there is an offense that's been committed. And the and I think it's Parks, but I can't remember now. It's the child abuse case where they didn't include the negligence instruction.
That was Erickson, I believe.
And
I was
sorry,
just going to ask you about that, because the lesser included offense that the defendant claimed wasn't given was manslaughter.
Okay. I was thinking it was child abuse is the one I was thinking
of. So the step instruction was intentional child abuse resulting in death, and then if they didn't find that, negligent child abuse.
Right.
But Mr. Erickson complained that the lesser included offense of manslaughter should have been charged. And the court said, yes, that was error because it is a lesser included offense. But because they found the intent element in the instruction, it was harmless error. How is that different than what we have?
Well, I think it's different because I think the negligence part is that's the way I read the case. And so maybe I was misreading it. But I took it as the negligence is the issue. They weren't able to differentiate between the intentional conduct of intentional child abuse versus negligent child abuse. And that was a concern. Whereas if you put a step instruction in, then there's no issue of prejudice because obviously they're able to consider that, are acquitted of the higher, move to the lesser, say, we think that's there, even though we don't think that he should be acquitted of the offense. And so,
Mr. Island, regard to the instructions that were given,
yes,
did the court specifically require the jury to find that the conduct of your client was willful?
It did.
If that's the case, would they ever get to the next part of saying, therefore, we're going to now consider whether or not it was not willful?
Actually, yes, that's the problem. If he had given a step instruction, there would be no issue here because they're able to do that. That's the way I read Blair and the way I read these issues of lesser included. It's to take or make sure that where theory is, where they should acquit, they say, hey, it's not willful, we should acquit. But we don't like the idea of acquitting someone under this conduct, so we're going to convict. And the only choice we have is to convict of this one offense. And that's why step instructions and lesser included instructions are imperative to be given, because we understand that in reality, even though in theory they should acquit you, they're not always likely to do so. And that's the way I read Blair and citing to Beck versus Alabama.
But if they are making a determination that his activity was willful, isn't that the same as intent, that he had the intent as in the step instruction case we were talking about with Erickson?
Well, that he may have had the willful intent, but I don't think that subs for the lesser included, because you don't resolve the problem of forcing the jury to make a choice between all or nothing. That seems to be the concerns that I read in the cases, was the all or nothing. So yes, they gave that definition, but if they didn't agree with that definition and didn't think that it occurred, but they thought something occurred, they are now forced into finding someone guilty because they're saying, wait a second, something happened here. We don't think it's right to acquit them of everything, and the only option we're left to use is the greater conviction. And that seems to be the theory behind lesser included offenses, is that you can separate that theory out from practice.
Let's look at the element of willfulness as the jury was instructed and the evidence here. As I understand the record, the evidence is your client passed two vehicles on the right side on the shoulder.
Correct.
And so that was, and was speeding. And
right.
So the traffic stop occurred, and I assume you're not.
We're not here talking about the traffic stop.
But in terms of the evidence of willfulness,
right,
we have your client admitting that what he did was not a good idea, it was completely stupid, and he knew he should not have done it.
Right.
So from a sufficiency of the evidence standpoint, doesn't that pretty directly point to willful conduct?
Well, no, because what I realize in retrospect, I get pulled over by a police officer, I know, and I look at what I'm doing, all of a sudden I reevaluate or rethink what I was doing. Just because I make admissions at the time that I'm stopped to something I shouldn't have done, or to some degree, as you've probably seen and I know we see all the time, people will want to agree with the police officer about the conduct where they think, okay, yes, this was wrong, and in this case, it was wrong. Yes, he shouldn't have done it. Yes, he should have known better. But that's all after the fact. That doesn't tell you what's going on in the fact, and that's what we as people generally understand, is sometimes we say things that aren't always necessarily correct for the moment when we do things, but in hindsight, we can always look at things and say we would have done a better job. And so I think that's a little different. Yes, that those are issues they could have considered, but it still doesn't mean that they could have said, you know what, we don't find that this was willful disregard for persons or property. They could have found instead that this is a wanton disregard, or he should have, basically, I should have known better, because he passed in a way that no vehicles had to respond, no vehicles had to brake, more than enough distance for safety. In fact, basically a lane's width away from any vehicle, and speeding a little bit, but barely over the speed limit of, I think, 4 or 5 miles an hour right in that area. So when you look at those facts, you know, yes, you can say in retrospect he made admissions, but they're not admissions that can completely say, or that somebody would say, yes, that means he did it willfully. Once again, we're into that. We're forcing the jury to elect an all or nothing, and that's where the problem comes.
Mr. Ireland, can you briefly discuss with us the prosecutorial misconduct assignment of error and why we should construe those statements as being representative of the defendant not testifying at trial, as opposed to statements he didn't make to the officer at the time?
Well, I think that's pretty, because basically they're not clarified and not making that clear. They're saying, you understand there has been no evidence shown by the defense. That's a statement saying we have a burden to establish that they didn't prove their case. That's the first problem. Second all is he never provided an excuse or reason that would exonerate him from intentionally doing the driving around or whatever. And once again, that's shifting the burden. Well, they need to craft their arguments in a way if that's what they mean. But when they do it in such a vague and indirect manner and seems to be commenting directly on the defendant's failure to testify, they have now not only commented on that failure to testify, but they've also shifted the burden to the defense to prove that he didn't perform the conduct. And that's misconduct, along with the idea of saying that it was a charade, and then directly commenting on counsel's comment, not on the defense or whatever the issues were for the defense, but on counsel's arguments. And that's where the problem comes in that case.
Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Could I ask one question before you step back?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
As to the comments made by the prosecutor concerning the comments made by you.
Yes.
Didn't the judge give the instruction to the jury, caution them that anything that the lawyers say is not evidence and should not be considered by them as anything they should consider in determining the case?
They do that in every case, but in this case that doesn't solve it, because they've attacked directly the integrity of the trial process, of the participants, whether it's the government or the defendant's lawyer, and all of a sudden now they're calling into question that integrity and ability to represent the case. And I think it's the Barfield, but I might be wrong, that talks about, you know, the government has kind of this status, and when they start throwing out aspersions on opposing counsel, that status is being raised up and much more likely to be given weight, even though it shouldn't be, to be given weight to then weigh how they're going to evaluate the evidence.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. How much time did we take the appellant over?
1 minute and 11 seconds.
Would you please add that to the appellee's time?
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. Sherbarth argues that the district court erred in affirming the county court judgment basically for three reasons. He claims, one, that the county court erred in failing to instruct on the lesser included offense of reckless driving. Two, he claims that the district court erred, the county court erred in failing to grant a mistrial based on alleged prosecutorial misconduct. And three, that the evidence was insufficient to support his conviction for willful reckless driving. I'll address each assigned error in detail here in a moment, but in short, as I set forth in my brief, we submit that his arguments are without merit, and we ask this court to affirm the judgment below. So beginning with the first issue, the failure to instruct on the lesser-included offense of reckless driving. As I said in my brief, it seems to me that this is not preserved for appellate review. The basic rule, as this court set forth in State v. Ellingson, is that when you're reviewing decisions of the district court, a higher appellate court will consider only those errors specifically assigned in the appeal to the district court, and again assigned as error in the appeal to the higher appellate court.
But the district court did address the error nevertheless, didn't it?
He did, under the sort of a plain error standard.
And we have that option as well.
Yes, you do have that option of addressing under plain error.
So let's address it.
Sure. The basically, it's not plain error by definition, I think, because plain error, as this court said in Wilson v. Wilson, as the Supreme Court said in State v. Jones, is that error uncomplained of at trial. This was obviously complained of at trial because he asked for the instruction, he objected to the failure to give it, and it was an issue throughout. So it's not plain error. As far as on the merits, our position is basically that for a lesser-included offense instruction to be given, you have to have, one, that it be a lesser-included offense, two, a rational basis to acquit of the greater offense and go to the lesser. There is no rational basis to acquit of the greater offense.
But did the district court address that prong of the test? It seems to me it went right from, it is a lesser-included offense, and it was error not to give it, mm-hmm. for one, right?
Right.
And you're not challenging that.
Well, I mean, frankly, the case law, I think, is a little bit not particularly clear on what is a lesser, if it's a lesser-included offense versus a lesser degree or even lesser-related offense, but based on Parks, as well as, I believe it was State v. Howard, it seems like it would be a lesser-included offense, particularly because careless driving is a lesser-included of reckless, and that's been stated several times.
Well, the district court then went right to whether it was prejudicial and
right.
didn't really address that second prong of a rational basis to acquit on
sure.
the higher offense, did it?
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And basically, I think you have that sort of the two-prong test, and if you look at, I forget the, I think it was State v. Parks. They set out that first two-prong test, and they say, okay, is it lesser included? Is a rational basis to acquit of the greater? Then they move to the prejudice prong. So, yes, I think the district court maybe skipped that step, but in our view, there was no rational basis to acquit of the greater offense because all the evidence suggested that it was a willful decision to pass these vehicles on the shoulder speeding, that he knew it was a dumb decision, that it could have caused an accident. He admitted to that. And I disagree, I guess, with counsel's assertion that those are only statements looking at his intent in hindsight or retroactively, I guess, because one, standard of review on sufficiency is in our favor and every inference is drawn in our favor to support the jury verdict that can be. And I think, too, that based on his statements, he clearly understood what he was doing was wrong at the time.
For a lesser included in offense, though, isn't the defendant entitled to have the jury determine which of the two offenses he should be convicted of? I mean, it seems like in this case, they weren't given the option. He's either guilty of willful reckless driving or he's guilty of nothing.
Well, and I think that kind of goes more toward the prejudice inquiry because, well, like I said, first, our position is that you didn't really need to get the lesser included because of that second prong on the rational. There's no rational basis to acquit of the greater and then move to the lesser. But on the prejudice inquiry, it seems to me that as Judge Embody, I think, implied, if you had a step instruction and they decide willful, you're done. You don't go on to the next part of the analysis, the lesser included offense. And what I think the issue really is and what opposing counsel emphasized is what they talked about in Blair and Beck, which is basically, hey, if it's such a serious offense and they're not given, you know, if they don't think you've proved the greater, and they're not given any other option, they might be basically forced into finding them guilty of the greater offense. I don't think that applies here. Both Beck and Blair involved pretty serious offenses. Beck was a death penalty case. Blair was a child abuse resulting in death case, where it kind of does make sense. I understand the rationale behind the U.S. Supreme Court's decision there that, okay, if they think you're guilty of something, we're talking serious offense, a death, something like that, they might be inclined to find conviction even if they think it was actually a lesser offense. You don't have that here. It's a Class 3 misdemeanor. It's a willful reckless driving that he got fined and a one-month revocation. You don't have the, I guess, pressure on the jury to convict of a greater offense if they don't think the state met the burden. Additionally, I'd point out as far as the prejudice inquiry that juries presumed to follow their instructions. If they had been given a step instruction, as Judge Embody had pointed out, I think they would have stopped and found them guilty of willful, reckless driving. And guess that kind of is all I have to say on the first issue. Unless there are further questions, I'll move on to the alleged prosecutorial misconduct. And in our view, that basically the district court and the county court were both correct in saying that, you know, there was no prosecutorial misconduct, or at least no mistrial warranted. As I reviewed the record, the comments were directed at his failure to make statements at the time of the incident, not a failure to testify at trial. We see those statements as comments on the evidence, not on comments on his silence. But in any event, even if you construe them that way, those comments were proper under the relevant case law because it was before Miranda and it was before the arrest, so it was perfectly fine to comment on a defendant's silence at that point in time.
Isn't the problem the phraseology as opposed to the fact that the argument was made? The way I understand it, the prosecutor directed not only to the jury the fact that the defendant did not explain what was the situation, but also attack the defense counsel.
Well, certainly I think that's what opposing counsel is taking issue with, is how it was phrased. But we submit that when you view the comments in context, I think it is clear that those comments on the silence or what the defendant did or did not do did not comment on failure to testify, so it wasn't a violation of Griffin v. California. Any comments on silence were before Miranda, before arrest, so they were proper under the Doyle v. Ohio framework. And the as the district court found, there was no shifting of the burden of proof. I acknowledged in my brief that, you know, I thought some of the comments were perhaps less than clear, but as a whole, I think the prosecutor told the jury that it's the state's burden to prove beyond reasonable doubt every element of the crime. The instructions told him that. Defense counsel said that in his closing argument as well. As far as the charade comment, I liken that to the Nebraska Supreme Court's decision in State v. Nolan, 2015, where they talked about prosecutors characterizing the defense counsel's arguments as smoke screens and mirrors. I think that's very similar to a charade characterization. They found that not to be prosecutorial misconduct, but basically a comment on the evidence.
And I believe from the instructions, the court specifically said the burden of proof is on the state.
Yes.
And also that the statements of counsel should not be considered as evidence.
Yes, I agree.
But when the charade comment was made, there was an objection at that time, and the court basically just told the prosecutor to move on. It didn't rule on the objection, and it didn't specifically instruct the jury at that time to disregard that comment, did it?
No. My recollection of the record is basically it was an admonishment to the prosecutor, don't do that again. I don't know that there was any other instruction. There was not another instruction to the jury, but like I said, I think it's basically equivalent to what that comment was in State v. Nolan that the Nebraska Supreme Court said is not prosecutorial misconduct. Basically, it's a comment on the evidence, and to the extent it is improper, say Nolan is distinguishable. It's an isolated incident. He's admonished. You have the instruction saying that what they say is not evidence. I don't think one isolated comment in the context of the entire trial and closing arguments warrants a mistrial. As far as the sufficiency of the evidence, as Your Honor pointed out, there are numerous admissions from the defendant that I think basically decide the case. The relevant standard of review is in the state's favor at this stage of the appeal. So we're looking at the language of the statute, 60-6214, and it's any person who drives any motor vehicle in such a manner as to indicate a willful disregard for the safety of persons or property shall be guilty of willful reckless driving. I think passing on the shoulder, huge clouds of dust and dirt coming up at 70 miles an hour, which was speeding in that area, along coupled with his admissions that what I did was stupid, I know that, I knew that, it could have caused an accident. That is sufficient for a rational trier of fact to find every essential element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Unless there are further questions, I did want to comment really briefly on the first issue, the preservation of error, because Your Honor, Judge Moore, Chief Judge Moore, you talked about the district court actually having considered the error, and I know that the Court of Appeals has a number of cases that talk about, you know, if it's actually considered, we can go ahead and address it. State v. Zimmerman, I think 2012 was the one I was thinking of off the top of my head. But if you trace that proposition of law back, it comes to the decision, Nebraska Supreme Court decision, Lindsay v. Mead, which is 244 Nebraska 645. And if I may just briefly finish my thought.
Yes.
And the relevant language there, they're basically talking about that when no such statement of errors is filed, an appellate court may at its discretion consider errors assigned in the appellate court, provided that the record shows that those errors were also assigned in the district court. And I think the only way to make sense of that statement is to look at the facts of that particular case where the district court opinion noted that there was a statement of errors, that there was 8 assigned errors, and it consolidated into 1, but nothing was filed in the record until after the decision. So I think what the Supreme Court is saying is that we can consider assigned errors as long as they're assigned in both levels of courts if the record suggests that the statement of errors was timely filed, even if it's not in the transcript. We ask you to affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time did we allow Appley to go over?
57 seconds.
Mr. Island, if you would like to have rebuttal on the issue of statement of errors only.
Sure. Lindsay versus Mead is the case I also looked at. The cases I've read talk about if it's considered, then it's able to be reviewed by this court. It was assigned in the court, assigned before the decision, actually. It was signed probably a month or two before. I can't remember the exact date, but it was an amended assignment. There was an assignment of errors timely filed, an amended assignment of errors because you review the record and you realize there are things maybe that you overlooked, and you added it. And so it was definitely assigned, definitely addressed for this court to be able to review.
Thank you. Thank you both. You are excused, and your case is submitted.
Thank you.
Our next case this morning is In Re Interest of Jaden J.